Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on February 4th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is, Are Regulatory Budgets Paying Off? A Year 2 Look Back at Executive Order 13771. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us a pair of two experts, and to start us today is Adam White, who is Assistant Professor and Director of the Scalia Law School C. Boyden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State, and a Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. After our speakers give their remarks today, we will move to an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for this subject or for one of our speakers. Thank you very much for sharing with us today, Adam. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Wesley, and thank you everybody for joining us today. When President Trump took office in January of 2017, one of his very first actions in office was to sign Executive Order 13771, which was titled Reducing Regulation and Controlling Regulatory Costs. Now, for nearly 40 years, the White House has undertaken centralized oversight of executive agency rulemaking through the now well-familiar program administered by the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, better known as OIRA. And OIRA's main job is overseeing the cost-benefit analysis and an interagency review of major rules arising from executive branch agencies. The innovation of Executive Order 13771 was to supplement that process with two new standards. First, the imposition of what's commonly known as a regulatory budget, capping an agency's aggregate costs that it imposes on society. And then second, Executive Order 13771 also instituted a standard that's commonly known as two out, one in, or the two for one rule, which required agencies to eliminate two old rules for every new rule that was promulgated. Almost exactly 2 years after the signing and promulgation of that order, it was signed on January 30th of 2017 and appeared in the Federal Register on February 3rd, 2017. We thought it would be an opportune moment to look back at the administration of that program now, and who better to discuss this with than our friend Jeffrey Harris. Jeff is a Consovoy, McCarthy, and Park, but more importantly for present purposes, he served as associate administrator in OIRA during the implementation of Executive Order 13771. And so, Jeff, it's a real pleasure and honor to have you here today. Why don't I turn the floor over to you to discuss your observations on the first 2 years of EO 13771, and then we'll have a little question and answer before turning it over for audience questions.
Great. Well, thank you to the Federalist Society for having me, and great to be here talking with Adam, who's an old friend going back to law school, so looking forward to a good discussion. I should also repeat the disclaimer, although I was in the government for some of what we'll be discussing, I'm only talking in my own capacity and not on behalf of anyone else. To reiterate the two big features of Executive Order 13771, which Adam mentioned, I think when people think of this, they tend to think of the one in, two out component, which was certainly, I think, the piece that got the most press, which says each agency, for every new regulatory action it takes, it must also take two deregulatory actions. And that's obviously an important part of it, but I think in some ways the regulatory budget could be even more consequential in the long run. And what that said was for fiscal year 2017, which is now passed, every agency had to keep its new regulatory costs across the agency at or below zero, which was unprecedented. I mean, there's never before been any direction to an agency, even using a comprehensive regulatory budget, much less, you know, instructing them to make it negative, which means on the whole, they're lifting more regulatory costs than they're imposing. And I think it's important to think of the way in thinking about 13771, that these two components work together. So I view the regulatory budgets as focusing on bigger picture things. So the budget is going to be saying, if an agency is taking actions that are imposing costs on the private sector, it also needs to be thinking about big picture ways to be offsetting that. Because again, they got pretty clear direction from the president that we need to be thinking about ways to streamline and reduce regulation instead of increasing them. So I think that's focusing more on your bigger ticket type items, whereas the two for one, I think, is also important. But I view that as more of a cleanup function. So this is where agencies are encouraged to do things like clean up old guidance documents, or clean up old information collection requests, or clean up old, you know, there's so much, someone used the term regulatory dark matter of these things that just get out there and accumulate. And the two for one, I think, really gives them a powerful incentive not only to slow down the issuance of new things, but to go back in their books and just discard things that aren't working. I think, you know, the education department very controversially has relied on things called Dear Colleague letters, which are not notice and comment rules. They're not, there's no formal process. And those have gotten a lot of criticism because a lot of people felt that they were allowing the agency to just make policy very informally without any proper process. And so those are the types of things that are really tailor-made for the two-for-one rule. Thinking about where we are 2 years in, I'll start with addressing how well it's worked, and then we'll talk about some of the challenges and complexities of working through these new policies for the first time. So I'll start by addressing a criticism that some folks actually on both the right and left have said about the Trump administration's deregulatory activity. So I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have suggested that the two for one thing is just sort of a gimmick, or it's just a talking point. And there have been some reports in Bloomberg and elsewhere that suggested that, you know, they seem to say, why is this a big deal? And they've criticized the administration for saying, you're just getting rid of little things and you're not, you know, you're not actually making any big structural changes. So starting with the numbers, so in 2018, the administration claimed a net $23 billion in regulatory cost savings, and they're projecting another $18 billion in cost savings in 2019, which, you know, those are big and impressive numbers. But I think, you know, some critics might say, well, those are just a small drop in the bucket in the context of a $20 trillion economy. And so, you know, billions are just rounding errors. But my reaction to this line of argument is, I think the clear overarching message from 13771 is just to send an absolutely powerful signal to the private sector that this sort of never-ending one-way ratchet of increasing regulation is over. And I think throughout much or all of the Obama administration, it was just nonstop, ever-changing regulations that were really seeking to remake entire industries. So you had, you know, the Clean Power Plan, the Waters of the United States rule, the net neutrality rule, all of the Obamacare implementing regulations. You had the methane rules about fracking. You had the overtime rule about labor policy. And it was really just regulation after regulation after regulation. And I think there was a real sense of exhaustion from the private sector of just never knowing what rules they're going to face when they're making investments in long-term plans, and they just could never have the certainty that this is what the regulatory framework is going to look like. And so, again, I think that wholly apart from anything about nose counting or numbers or anything, the big thing about 13771 is it just sends a pretty clear signal that those days are over. And I do think there were a lot of agencies that literally viewed their mission as just saying, this is a one-way ratchet, and we define progress in this area as just every single opportunity, just increase. And again, this is unprecedented. One analogy I've used before, I think for purposes of the sort of H.W. Bush, Clinton, and W. Bush administrations, you know, the Clinton administration was obviously more regulatory, and the Bush administrations were less regulatory and even deregulatory. But, you know, I think they were mostly playing between the 30 and 40 yard lines. But then I think the Obama administration went far beyond even the Clinton administration in terms of just the cost and the complexity and just industry after industry after industry that they were really trying to remake in the model that they preferred. And so I think 13771 is sort of the reaction to that of saying, you know, here's the big signal to the private sector that you don't need to worry about that continue to happen. And I think Director Mulvaney, while he was at the CFPB, had a really good quote about this, as he said, you know, the Obama administration often viewed their regulatory goal as, quote, pushing the envelope of what they can do. And he took a pretty hard line that it's not a regulator's job to push the envelope. It's a regulator's job to follow their statutory authority and to protect consumers and implement the legislation that they oversee. But it's not the role of a regulator to push the envelope and sort of maximize and sometimes exceed all of their power. So my first big takeaway about 13771, I think just simply putting the brakes on this constant one-way flow of regulation has been a really almost sort of generational accomplishment. And I think there are definitely some folks who take an issue or have had thoughts on both sides of just how much deregulation has been happening. But I think that sort of glosses over what is a really substantial achievement in its own right, which is just, again, putting the brakes on the new regulation. And the second reaction I have to some of these other observations about 13771 is that a lot of the biggest ticket items, so I've already mentioned some, the Clean Power Plan at EPA, the Waters of the United States rule, the CAFE fuel economy standards, the overtime rule, a lot of these biggest ticket items are still in progress just because the nature of the rules, I think, means, you know, of course, the agency has to do its research, has to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking, has to take and respond to comments, has to finalize the rule. Then, of course, they're inevitably challenged in court. And so a lot of these really big ticket items are still in the pipeline and will hopefully be finished in the next year or certainly hopefully two. And so something like the CAFE, the fuel economy standards, I mean, that's actually a regulation that, you know, even by the standards of the economy, I mean, that's hundreds of billions of dollars of compliance costs, depending on the scope of that rule and about whether, you know, the auto industry will have to keep, you know, making investments and taking efforts to comply with all of these various federal mandates or, you know, focus more on selling cars that consumers are demanding. So I think, you know, to the extent some have taken issue with some of the numbers or the extent of deregulation, I think, you know, there's a really good start, but some of the things that are going to be the most consequential are still in the pipeline. So none of that's to say, of course, that there aren't challenges and complexities in doing this because of course there are. So just wanted to quickly walk through some of the things that I think have been open issues about how to implement these new policies and how the administration's addressed it so far. So one of them is when you think about a regulatory budget, for 2017, the regulatory budget for each agency was simply zero. They were merely instructed to not impose more costs than they were lifting. But for 2018 and going forward, the executive order delegated to the OMB director and OIRA the ability to basically find a good methodology to set the caps. And what they came up with, I think, is a pretty neat compromise. The problem with a regulatory budget is, of course, agencies all have different mandates. They all have different degrees of existing regulation, different functions. And so whereas an agency like EPA or the Transportation Department regulates a ton and probably has tons of room to deregulate, others such as, you know, the Social Security Administration or some of the financial regulators, you know, some of those just do less regulation. And so there's less room for that. So what the administration did is it linked the regulatory budget process to the unified agenda, which is where each agency annually projects the regulations that it'll be addressing over the next year. And in this process, the agency will go to OMB and say, this is what we're proposing as our regulatory budget for next year. And then they have a back and forth process with OMB where, you know, the agency says, this is what we think is feasible. These are what we think our priorities will be. And then there might be some engagement with OMB or the White House or other components of the government. And then OMB ultimately assigns each agency a specific budget. So they're all negative or zero this year. And unsurprisingly, I think some agencies like EPA and Interior and Transportation have pretty large negative numbers, whereas others like, you know, DHS, of course, has national security functions where you tend to think less in terms of regulatory or deregulatory. I think a lot of those simply have a zero. So for those types of agencies, they simply need to not be imposing more cost than they're lifting through deregulation, but others are expected to be hitting a much stronger negative number. Yeah, so I think the goal is to work with the agency and come up with numbers that are feasible, but still are going to be aggressive and giving them something to, you know, hopefully accomplish that are a little more aspirational. Another complexity is what counts. So for purposes of two-in, or the purposes of the one-in, two-out policy, what counts as a regulatory action? And this has been a source of some of the criticism where the administration was accused of making it mostly about small bore things. But I think that that's a little bit myopic just because the whole nature of the one-in, two-out policy is designed to be cleaning up the book. So I think for purposes of that, what the administration has said is, absolutely, if you appeal a guidance, if you repeal a letter, if you repeal an information collection, pretty much anything the agency does that's removing an obligation from the books, lifting a burden on the private sector, OMB will give the agency credit for that in terms of the one in, two out. But for purposes of the regulatory budget, they've taken the view that only items for which economic analysis is included will count against the regulatory budget. So I think for all intents and purposes, what that means is one in, two out is really going to be a broader view, and the regulatory budgets are pretty much only going to be final rules that have gone through the notice and comment process, because those are the types of rules which will always include cost-benefit analysis and economic analysis, and there's generally going to be a little more robust analysis there. So that's sort of the balance they've struck in terms of how to implement this and what things count. Another complexity here. You know, here's another one. Some rules, of course, and this is an issue with cost benefit analysis more generally. Some rules are just not amenable to a hard cost benefit analysis. So, think for example of a rule that promotes broad protection of conscience rights for religious groups. That rule might impose costs on businesses or hospitals that might need to comply with this, but the benefits are going to be more intangible because it's going to be protecting religious liberty, which is, of course, a critical constitutional concern, but it's not something you can do in dollars and cents. And so, you know, that gets a little more complicated and very complicated, in fact, of how you would fit those into the 13771 framework. And I think in terms of things like that, there hasn't really been a hard and fast rule. I think the way something like that would generally be treated is if there's something that we know has real benefits that advances the administration's priorities, but happens to impose costs, I think that's something that the OMB director has the power to and probably would exempt from the 13771 rule. So if a religious liberty promoting rule served important constitutional functions, but also imposed some costs, I think what the director of OMB could say is, well, we're not going to hold this against you in terms of your regulatory budget or your one in, two out, because we recognize that this is promoting important administrative or administration priorities. And then the last thing I'll just briefly address before taking some questions is another complexity is what happens if a rule is required by statute. So a really interesting case study is a rule from the Agriculture Department that just came out about genetically modified food. So what happened is Vermont in the early 2000s started attempting to regulate genetically modified food, which when you think about the ability of one tiny state to get into regulation of food labeling could have catastrophic implications for sort of the whole supply chain across the country if every food company needs Vermont specific standards. And then imagine if 25 states had similar standards and all of them had different and overlapping requirements, it would be completely unworkable. And so Congress preempted state-level labeling regulation pertaining to genetically modified foods. But the compromise was, in exchange for that, the Agriculture Department had to promulgate a national federal standard about this. And I think the Agriculture Department has been pretty candid that this rule has no benefits for consumers. I think in terms of market research and things, first of all, there's never been any suggestion that genetically modified food is actually less safe than other food. And even if there were some difference, consumers almost certainly don't read these labels. And so the Agriculture Department said, well, we acknowledge that this rule has no benefits for consumers and is going to impose costs, but we're stuck because Congress is who told us to do this. And so I think the balance that was struck, and this is written up in the final rule, which I think came out in November or December, what it does is the rule accounts for the cost, but it also views the benefits of avoiding all of the state regulation. So the agency made an attempt to say, if Vermont and other states had followed a similar approach, you know, there would have been X dollars in costs, but now those are avoided regulatory costs because the same statute that forced the USDA to do this rule also preempted those other rules. So it's, you know, so I think that's a good creative way to say, you know, we acknowledge that the agency was boxed in by statute. And so, you know, we're not going to hold that against you. And we're going to recognize the bigger picture of a statute that also requires of a statute that both preempts state law and requires the agency to do this standard. So I'll stop there. Those are just a few of the you know, many complexities that have come up. But I think, again, I think the biggest takeaway for me from 13771 from 2 years in is I think it's just it's really changed a lot of the culture and the mindset in these agencies of even just in terms of agenda setting and just making them think, you know, the one-way ratchet is over. And now they have to be thinking not only in terms of how are we going to keep ratcheting up our regulations, but how are we going to be trying to streamline and ideally even cut things back. So it really is a pretty substantial culture shift compared to how things have been done in the past.
Well, thanks, Jeff. As we said, we'll have some audience questions. Let me just ask a couple of questions quickly as folks think about what they'd like to ask. First, just on the general impact of this executive order, as you said, it affects the mindset of the culture within the agencies as they go about their work of promulgating new regulations. But I kind of have to wonder, President Trump would have been a regulatory reformer or deregulatory president regardless of his executive order. He made very clear he stood on these things when he was campaigning, and I don't doubt that even in the absence of this order, he would have appointed Gavs and others who were energetic in a deregulatory or regulatory reform approach. So how much of what you described really is from this order? What difference might we have seen in the absence of this order?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like every executive order, and I should also mention, this executive order was challenged in court, but ultimately upheld by the district court in D.C., actually by an Obama appointee, Judge Moss, I believe. And you know, like every executive order, it can only be implemented in accordance with law. And so like every executive order, it does not carry the force of law per se, but it does carry the imprimatur of the president. So I think if the Energy Department were going to roll back an energy efficiency standards for dryers, they could not point to the order and say, well, we're not really sure about this regulation, but because we have to be meeting our cost caps and rolling back regs, we're going to do that. So that's sort of what they can't do because, you know, the APA and each agency's organic statute give considerations and virtually all, thankfully, of those considerations can include some consideration of cost, but the executive order on its own cannot force the agencies to do something that would otherwise violate the law. And in fact, this is one of the key reasons why the court upheld it, because they said, you know, the court said, of course, if an agency is doing something for an impermissible reason, that might be arbitrary and capricious. But I think the executive order itself is just aspirational is too weak of a word, but it is a directive from the president that these are my priorities and this is how I want them implemented. And these are the steps I want you to follow. And so I think it does matter. I mean, as between a fairly specific directive from the president to the heads of his agencies or not having that, I do think it changes the tone of the conversation. And, you know, and I don't think, I mean, I know there was never anything similar in the W. Bush administration or the H.W. Bush administration. And, you know, I think in the Reagan administration, even cost-benefit analysis was still sort of a new thing. And so, yeah, so I think it is aspirational. It does not carry the force of law, but I do think when this is one of the president's, literally one of the first things the president signed on some of the first days in office, I do think that sets the tone of just how agencies are thinking about this. And I will say, I think the fact that this is now being incorporated into the unified agenda process, which I mentioned briefly. So the unified agenda, once a year, every agency has to tell the public what they're planning to do in the next year in terms of regulation. And then they also have longer lists. They can say, you know, this is sort of the next year. And these are some things we're probably not going to get to this year, but we might get to over the next few years. And so I think it's really powerful in that in putting together their unified agenda and thinking these are what we want our priorities to be, I do think there's very much a sense that they really have to be thinking, well, in the event we need to be doing something regulatory, just as a matter of agenda setting, we need to also be thinking about things we can streamline or cut back on. And I think that agenda setting function is probably every bit as important as the pure, you know, bean counting analysis of where we are with the 2-for-1 or where we are with the regulatory budget.
Now that all makes sense to me. And you know, full disclosure, I'm on this executive order. I think it definitely was a good step in the direction that you painted. When I am debating this executive order with friends who disagree with its propriety or its utility, oftentimes the main criticism I hear is that agencies should always be focused on cost-benefit analysis or benefit-cost analysis, not just on cost analysis. That anytime a rule's benefits outweigh its cost, it's by definition a good thing, and that that's a mistake for agencies to look exclusively at cost in this analysis. Even this analysis is separate from the usual cost-benefit analysis, having simply cost analysis improperly excludes half of what the government should be thinking about, which is how can we benefit society and what we do. So how do you go about thinking about that and thinking through that in the context of this order? What does this add in addition to just what we'd get in cost-benefit analysis, and why are we excluding benefits from it?
No, that's a really good question. So I think a couple observations. I think just as an empirical matter, the benefit side of cost-benefit analysis is always vastly more complicated than the cost side. And even costs will often depend on assumptions or imputations or, you know, there's nothing ever ironclad. These are all just good faith, best possible estimates. But I think especially some of the benefit side things in some of the Obama era rules, I think it was really on the benefit side where, you know, if you come up with some notion of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of benefits based on some pretty implausible assumptions, all of a sudden you can be justifying these very costly rules. And so, of course, Executive Order 12866 still requires the agency to look at costs and benefits. So, you know, the 13771 side is just one piece of it. And in terms of 12866 and in terms of lots, you know, EPA, of course, you know, most or all of the relevant statutes would allow or require the agency to look at both costs and benefits. But I think 13771 reflected a different judgment of, you know, the regulatory cost period have gotten so exorbitant over the last 8 years that that's going to be the focus of that particular order. And I think a really good example of this is if you look at some of the documents EPA has put out on the Clean Power Plan, you know, there was something called the social cost of carbon that the previous administration used to justify some of these very, very expensive greenhouse gas rules. And I think EPA explained why a lot of the assumptions underlying those things were just completely, you know, just went a little too far in assuming too much. Or, for example, I think many of these measures would look at global effects and not just effects in the United States, whereas this administration said we're going to be looking at the domestic costs and benefits because that's a more appropriate way to assume this. So I think that the benefit side can often be much more sensitive to, you know, even small changes and assumptions can have massive changes in how you tally up the benefit side.
And on the benefit side, you know, one, I always like pointing listeners and readers to a paper by our colleague at the Federal Society's Administrative Law Practice Group, Susan Dudley, the former OIRA administrator, had a great paper a few years ago in the journal Business Economics. It was called In Perpetuating Puffery, an Analysis of the Composition of OMB's Reported Benefits of Regulation. And she really walks through, you know, as somebody experienced at OIRA, you know, walks through the ways in which agencies' own sort of self-interested benefit calculations do tend to track, their errors tend to be in one direction rather than the other. And so I highly recommend it. Well, maybe this is a good point at which, Wesley, you should open the floor to audience questions.
Of course. Thank you both so much. It does look like we do have one question out of the queue, so let's go ahead and move to our first caller then.
Thank you for really an excellent, great presentation. I really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. I have two questions. One is there a threshold dollar minimum of $100 million or something like that? And if so, how can we eliminate it for the benefit of the mom-and-pop enterprises that don't rise to visibility when you have big numbers like $100 million? Maybe that's seen as a small number by some, but for small businesses, it could be big. And the second question, what are the costs, or how would they be calculated, the costs of eroding structural federalism, that is, things like separation of powers, enumerated powers, etc.? Is there any way to take those into account?
Thank you. Yeah, those are both great questions. So on the first one, so I think the $100 million comes into place in two areas. So one is for purposes of the Congressional Review Act, it's one of the thresholds to consider to be considered a major rule, which would then be sent to Congress for its approval or disapproval under the Congressional Review Act. And the second place it comes into play is for triggering OIRA formal scrutiny. So OIRA reviews, you know, significant rules, which are defined in part as a rule that, you know, that might be over $100 million of impact. So, but what I would say is, and I think this actually partially will answer your separate question too. So at least with respect to the OIRA review, they not only have authority to review economically significant rules, but also rules, I don't have the specific language offhand, but it says rules that would have a significant, some sort of other significant impact on the administration's priorities or on, it's basically, and I apologize, I don't have the specific phrase, but it's sort of a catch-all that says if it's something that's likely to significantly impact the president's priorities, OIRA can pull it in and review it, even if it's not at the $100 million threshold. So I think in terms of federalism or separation of powers, I think that's exactly where those sorts of things would come in. So OMB or OIRA could say, if an agency is going to do something that would affect federalism interests or that would affect religious liberty or that would affect separation of powers, even if it doesn't get to $100 million. So think about something that might have to do with administrative law judges. You know, that might not affect $100 million of economic activity, but it, of course, as we know from the Supreme Court, raises all sorts of separation of powers issues. So that would be the sort of thing that could then be pulled in, and then OIRA would review it, the White House Counsel's Office would review it, DOJ would review it, and they'd run, you know, run this administration-wide policy process to make sure that the thing being issued will reflect the administration's priorities. Yeah, so that's a very good question. So at least for purposes of when something gets reviewed to ensure that it meets the administration's priorities, it's not just $100 million, but it can also be things that are important for non-monetary reasons as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And, you know, as kind of a follow-up, is there going to be, I guess, Naomi Rao, whom I've followed, seems to be great intellectual leadership in this area and practical leadership, nominated to the D.C. Circuit. Is that a clear, likely yes confirmation soon?
I guess we're the lawyers, not the politicos. Hearing is coming up very soon, I think maybe tomorrow. You know, no confirmation is ever guaranteed. Of course, the new rules in the Senate in the aftermath of Senator Reid eliminating the filibuster for Supreme Court or for judicial nominations, it only takes majority vote. Now there's definitely more than a majority of Republicans, and it's not hard to imagine Republican senators supporting her confirmation.
We do have another question in the queue. Here's our second caller.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for your work. Kent Huntington, Huntington Solutions, calling you. I have a question as to where you have an agency that isn't regulating under the Administrative Procedures Act, case in point being the FTC, using adjudications instead of rulemakings to govern the cybersecurity sphere. What can be done, and what do you think will be done in light of the 11th Circuit's decision in LabMD recently?
Jeff, just to clarify, I can't recall off the top of my head, does 13771 apply to independent agencies like the FTC? And if not, let's take just the broader step, the step backwards, so the more general question of how does this approach affect agency policymaking through vehicles other than rulemaking, right? Most famously, agency adjudication and enforcement.
Another really good question, so I'll take that in sort of two parts. The executive order does not on its face apply to independent agencies. Now, they still are subject to the unified agenda process, so they do need to comply with giving the public notice of what they're planning to do and sort of identifying what their priorities are over the next year or a couple of years. Many of the independent agencies have engaged in much better practices. So I think the FCC under Chairman Pai has really shored up its economic analysis. I think former acting director Mulvaney has done some terrific things at the CFPB. I think he has really instilled much more of a economically based approach to a lot of the CFPB rulemaking. So no, this president hasn't directly ordered them to do anything, but I do think there's a little bit of a race to the top where even the independent agencies realize the importance of this regulatory reform, of regulatory reform issues to the administration, and so are implementing best practices on their own, even apart from the executive order. And on adjudications, I have less insight into that. I think there's, for good reason, of course, the White House OMB side does not get involved in the litigation of any specific matter, certainly not any enforcement actions, because there's always been, you know, a separation between sort of political type stuff and policy type stuff, and then enforcement actions, while we've seen on the other side of the wall. So I don't have as much insight into that. I know that this is an issue that's near and dear to Don McGahn's heart, who was the White House counsel for most of the first administration. And, you know, although they didn't get involved in specific adjudications, I know Don felt very strongly and has spoken extensively about, you know, sort of best practices for adjudication. So just at a high level of saying, this is how we ensure due process. This is how we ensure that there isn't overreaching. You know, I think there have been a few DOJ memos that have been put out also about, you know, the use of guidance documents in adjudications and, you know, really encouraging agencies not to be relying on anything other than statutes and regulations in bringing enforcement actions. And so, although again, there's no ability of OMB or OIRA or the White House to be saying, you know, this is how I want this enforcement action run, they can certainly still promote best practices to help ensure due process. And I think there's, you know, pretty widespread agreement that agency adjudication and enforcement has gotten a little bit out of control, and I think are trying at a high level to adopt some best practices to rein that in.
Just a quick follow-up, and I'm focused in on the FTC because their structure was ripped down by the 11th Circuit in the LabMD case last June, but the agency itself is still pursuing independent legal authority. Is there any way to rip that away from them? Because usually if you had DOJ involved, you would have the White House somewhat involved, or you would have at least the Attorney General involved. But in these cases, with the FTC having the independent legal litigating authority, they're out there on their own, still litigating cases like D-Link out, which is going to trial in, I believe, next spring out in San Francisco.
Well, this is Adam. I do know that much of the FTC's independent litigating authority, like for similar agencies, is actually a creature of statute. The FTC Act authorizes the commission to represent itself in various cases. And so my guess is that actually the FTC out of the independent authority category would require an act of Congress.
I think that's a good idea. Okay, thank you, guys.
Next caller, you're up.
Yeah, I was just looking at the NRDC case that sought to stay this, and I noticed that it was dismissed on the grounds of lack of ripeness and standing, and then they came forward last April with 10 additional complaints showing that they had ripe claims and that they had standing. My question is really a practical one, and I haven't looked through the file, but I mean, did they come up with real live people who said, because of this executive order, I've been personally harmed in some way? And can you give us an example of what kind of personal harm comes from a lack of regulation?
That's a great question. And, you know, I haven't followed the ins and outs of all of it recently, but I think it would just be very, very hard to claim that any particular rule, because I think the administration would fully agree that every regulation or deregulatory action must always stand on its own 2 feet. And so even if something is taken under the umbrella of 13771, no one disputes that it has to comply with the agency statute, that it has to be justified by the record, that it has to be not arbitrary and capricious. And so I haven't seen these latest declarations from the NRDC, but I think it would be very hard, if not impossible, for someone to claim somehow that 13771 uniquely imposed any specific harm on them, which would essentially have to mean the agency wasn't going to do the regulation unless, you know, but for 13771, which I'm certainly not aware of anything like that that's out there. And, you know, I do remember the first opinion dismissing the case, I guess, without prejudice, you know, seemed to be pretty skeptical of whether anyone would be able to bring these claims. So I'm not sure what they've repled, but based on how I read the initial opinion, I think it would be really hard for someone to show that they personally were injured in a concrete and tangible way by 13771, because that's just not how the executive order works. I mean, any deregulatory action always has to be justified for reasons wholly apart from that.
Okay, thanks. Well, maybe I'll pull it up on Pacer and see what they came up with. But thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. We still have one question in the queue. Here's our next caller.
Hello, this is John Chu in California. Thank you very much for your presentation. I actually have two questions, if you please. Number one, this is all well and good, and it's a big step. But what happens when we have an administration in the future that isn't so concerned about reigning the administrative state, or might even be concerned about expanding the administrative state? And then the second question I have is there ever been a situation where you have two agencies that have cross-lapping jurisdiction, say the FTC and the DOJ on antitrust, or the SEC and one of the banking regulators, comptroller, on some issue, where they don't agree on which two need to be rescinded or what the result of the cost-benefit analysis actually is?
Jeff, try to picture yourself in this dystopian future where regulations are increasing rather than decreasing.
Yeah, so unfortunately, the good news is the basic principles of cost-benefit analysis, you know, which date back to really the Ford, Nixon, Carter administrations, and then, you know, really pretty significantly in the Reagan administration, you know, 12866, which is currently sort of the founding document of a lot of cost-benefit analysis, and that is a Clinton-era executive order. And so, you know, the Obama administration did not rescind that, even though, you know, there's great stuff in 12866. I mean, it says, you know, agencies should only regulate when they're required by law, or when there's a compelling public need, or when there's a market failure. It says agencies should always be looking at alternatives. It says agencies should always be thinking about whether, you know, other government regulations have caused the problems that give rise to the need for a new regulation. So the good news is those basic principles have persisted. The bad news is for people who are critical of the Obama administration, there might be a sense of, well, who cares if they left 12866 on the books if they're going around doing things like the Clean Power Plan and the net neutrality regulation and the overtime regulation and all of these extremely costly regulations, which often have questionable benefits. I think the basic framework may prevail, although with, you know, the sort of new populism among a lot of folks on the left, maybe it won't. And they'll just say, you know, no, we look at benefits and not costs. I think in light of cases like Michigan v. EPA and, you know, a lot of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence and the interpretation of EPA's organic statutes, I think it would be hard for either an administration or a specific agency to all of a sudden start taking the position that cost is irrelevant. I guess that's sort of unsatisfying. I mean, I hate to say it, a Democratic administration would probably rescind 13771 on their first day in office. I think it's great. I think it's done a lot of good things, but the broader framework of cost-benefit analysis has sort of hung on in bipartisan form, although again, with varying degrees of compliance with it. But I think the explicit cost-lifting deregulatory premise probably is going to depend on who the occupant of the White House is, which I guess is probably how it should be in a Republican form of government. But, and then your second question is the easier one, I think. There are lots of rules that are multiple agency, you know, the CAFE one is the biggest one, the corporate or the fuel economy standards, which is a joint EPA Transportation Department rule. The Waters of the United States rule is a joint rule of EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. And they usually have, they usually find some way to amicably divide the credit, you know, which I think is usually 50-50, or if it's a really lopsided allocation of responsibility, they'll find some way to do that with the help of the OMB director. But definitely a situation that, that comes up all the time, and it is built into the 13771 calculus.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, John, for your questions. Seeing no immediate questions, and you still have time if you want to, I turn the mic back to Adam and Jeff. Do you have any further commentary for us?
Well, this is Adam. I do want to thank Jeff for taking the time to offer these insights. I know a lot of us on the outside, both in private practice and in academia, have, you know, we're intrigued by the promulgation of this order, trying to understand what exactly it would mean in practice. And, you know, now with the advantage of the benefit of 2 years behind us, I really appreciate Jeff taking the time to offer his perspective on how things have actually played out so far.
Thank you. Yeah, and express my thanks as well to the Federal Society for having me, and to Adam and the panelists for leading some great questions. And the last thing I'll say is I think it's a really interesting time for administrative law. I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think a lot of the stuff like the Super Bowl yesterday in the Clinton and Bush administrations was kind of between the 30 or 40 yard line. But I think we did have a really sharp swing in the Obama administration. And so now you've got this administration, which is still, you know, in the courts and still trying to sort of undo some of this Obama stuff, but also move with an affirmative agenda. So I don't think we've seen the pendulum swing this much, certainly in the last several decades. And so I think it's a really interesting time for administrative law continuing to develop by the day. Appreciate everyone joining the conversation, and I really enjoyed it too.
Wonderful. Well, Adam and Jeff, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us for this call. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.